Hey guys, I'm Sagar Njeti.
And I'm Marshall Kozloff. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we're excited to bring you our conversation about the populist left and the populist right's growing concerns about technology with Matt Stoller and Zach Graves. Matt is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, where he studies the threat of concentration and monopoly power in our economy. He is the author of a new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Populism, which will be released in October.
Zach is the head of policy at the Lincoln Network, an organization which is focused on bridging the gap between Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley.
Over the last few years, we've seen a growing backlash against Silicon Valley tech companies, from the left and from the right. There are congressional inquiries into Facebook and Google. The Department of Justice is examining antitrust concerns in technology. And debates about the ethics of cooperation with the U.S. and Chinese militaries have taken on a lot of new relevance.
For a long time, there was a narrative among policymakers that the success of tech companies like Uber and Airbnb, along with the adoption of extra-governmental cryptocurrencies, left government in the backseat. As any tech CEO facing congressional hearings and subpoenas now knows, though, that's very much not the case today.
This all seems to be driven by a negative change in attitude towards technology companies, which are seen by some as monopolies and malign actors. As the fast-growing and most innovative sector of our economy, big tech must learn to navigate these new Washington power dynamics.
When we talked with Matt and Zach, we covered the origins of the big tech backlash, whether focusing on biased accusations against social media and search companies is productive, the role that tech will play in a great power competition between the U.S. and China, and whether or not tech company innovations have played a constructive role in the American economy. Let's dive in. All right, Matt Stoller, Zach Graves, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
We were speaking recently with somebody in Silicon Valley. They founded a company in the 2010s. They told us they don't think about the government at all. And Marshall and I were both really struck by that because they don't realize that the government and the populist left and right are very much thinking about them. And that's really why we want to talk to both of you guys today.
And we think that part of what's fueling the government's interest in tech companies and discussions of monopoly is the fact that the populist left and the populist right are putting a lot of pressure on these places. So, Zach, you wrote a piece in Medium about how Silicon Valley needs to engage better with the post-Trump right. So firstly, what exactly is the post-Trump right?
Well, I mean, that's what the whole realignment is about. We're figuring that out. The point is just that there's a shift of the right-wing coalition away from the sort of anti-communist Reagan-era fusionism. And there's some different emerging factions there. I think generally the trend seems to be a little more critical of big business, a little less inclined to libertarian orthodoxies. And so what I was talking about in that piece was just how those things are coming together in a way that I don't think the big tech companies have really anticipated or understood, particularly as many of them have set up big offices here in recent years. I think, you know, Zuckerberg getting called before Congress a year or so ago was a big wake-up call that, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
No, that's a really important point. And Matt, you know, anybody in D.C. who thinks about breaking up companies of any kind immediately knows about you and your Twitter feed. So what is your central thesis about big tech and where that stands today, particularly when it comes to tech policy?
So I'm going to start with the question that you asked, which was, you know, they're saying they don't think about government, and that's just not true.
Yeah.
Right? It's not true. They may think they don't think about government, but it's pretty obvious that when they all came together in this kind of club to start a global currency, Libra, that those
you mean Facebook by that.
The club of Facebook and the other people who are scared of Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
They all came together, and Facebook then went to Congress and had a bunch of hearings, and they were thoroughly embarrassed because it's such a terrible idea and so poorly thought through that they made Congress look good, right? I mean, that was and obviously a lot of people in Silicon Valley were paying attention to that, and that changed the conversation around cryptocurrencies, and it changed the conversation around how they were going to organize this whole new sector of the political economy. It was obviously they were paying attention to Congress and to government, and it really mattered. So it's not true when they say they're not paying attention to the government in D.C. But what they mean by that is that they don't pay attention to law. Ah. So there's a lawlessness to Silicon Valley that's pretty profound, and they have accumulated enormous amounts of power because we don't enforce the law anymore. And so they are effectively acting as private governments. Mm-hmm. So one of the arguments that you see on the conservative side, and you see it in its own way on the liberal side, and I'm a liberal Democrat, but you see this kind of, I think one of the big shifts that's happened is people don't look at these Silicon Valley Goliaths like their businesses. They look at them like they're private governing forces, because that is fundamentally what, when I see these companies, I look at it and I say that's a monopoly. And a monopoly is a private government that sets the terms and conditions over a particular market. And these companies are setting terms and conditions over really important markets, which are the markets for information and advertising, essentially the free press. So they are dominating incredibly important parts of our society, and they're setting terms and conditions and governing those. And you even see it something as simple as, you know, Mark Zuckerberg saying, I'm going to start a Supreme Court for content moderation, and I'm going to start a global currency, and we need to think about separations of powers. And this does not sound like a business, right? This sounds very government-like. Mm-hmm. So What does that mean? I mean, that changes the politics here, and it means that they're intersecting with public officials in much more profound ways than they had been just when they were making microchips.
Mm-hmm. And something we're both interested in, firstly, is the real origins of this tech backlash. Because if you look back 5-6 years ago, none of this was on the table, especially on the right. I used to work for Firing Line, and when we had Scott Walker on the show, he was talking about how he's traveling the country and evangelizing for conservatism. And he says what he tells young people is, quote, conservatism is like Uber and liberalism is like a taxi company, which in the year 2019, that sort of shocked me, because the only time Uber really comes up in conservative circles now is some dunk about, you know, failed IPOs or sort of discussions about how the companies are actually going to make money. So what really happened, Zach, between 2013, when you sort of saw the Uber entrepreneurship, gig economy is a positive thing, and 2019, when it'd be hard to imagine an up-and-coming senator discussing Silicon Valley tech companies in positive terms?
Yeah, I mean, like, there are lots of bad examples we've had since the you know, sort of people, I think you're right, a few years ago, put Silicon Valley up on a pedestal and said this is a, you know, great triumph of American capitalism, and largely I think they're right. But there have been some people that have sort of stepped in it. Like, we have Theranos as a very bad example. Uber's previous CEO, Travis Kalanick, certainly had some missteps and scandals involved mm-hmm. during his tenure, and I think Republicans are a little more skeptical of that now. I want to touch on also a point that Matt made, which is the sort of, you know, private versus public governance. I think there's lots of examples of private institutions that have a lot of power over us. So I think we need a little more clarity about when that crosses the line into something that's a concern of public policy. Because, you know, the internet has private governance institutions like ICANN, which, you know, helps set, you know, domain name policy. They have, you know, my employer can tell me a lot of things and what to do about how I like run my life on a day-to-day basis, but we don't necessarily think that should be regulated.
So that's an important point, and that's something that we'll get to soon.
Well, just to interject on that, I think where the line comes in is the topic of individualism and where the individual plays in these structures, right? Because the point of government, especially within the limited government framework, is that a individual has an ability to be to hold it accountable. But if you're talking about a private monopoly, I think there's a concern that that's not something that could be held accountable in any way whatsoever, especially when there's such power that you can't really imagine an individual consumer impacting Facebook's bottom line in a way that would change behavior.
Right. Mm. I mean, there are, you know, interesting critiques of sort of private power there and sort of the soft exertion of power that I think the, you know, old like libertarian hardline framework doesn't really have a good way to talk about. And so that being said, though, I think there's not necessarily agreement as to what the particular harms are between the populist left and the populist right about what a lot of the right, you know, wants to ban pornography on the internet. That's not where the left wants to come at it from. Mm-hmm. They have like different grievances in some ways.
Absolutely. That's an important point. Matt, I want to get you in on that point in particular, too, about the role of the individual. So I think one of the reasons that this has become such a thing, both on the populist left and the right, is that there is a growing concern in our atomized society that these companies like Google, Facebook, or whomever have such control over our day-to-day lives, or at least perceived penetration into how we interact with that technology. And so also just a response to what Zach said here.
Yeah, so I think that's really the core question, which is what's the relationship of the citizen to the state and to who is the state, and how do we think about our own power, right? So, Zach, I think you said something important where you talked about how there are a lot of institutions, private institutions, that have power over us. And I think that's true. And, you know, the question is, where do you draw the line? How do you draw the line? Who draws the line? Those are important questions. But what's changed in the debate, I think, in both the right and the left is, and it sort of started, I think, with the financial crisis, is that question of power, right? We didn't used to think about the private sector as a place where power was exerted. We thought of the private sector as a place where people competed within markets. They didn't have power, right? Consumers had choice. Right, that's the idea there is if you're a consumer, no one has power over you because you can always choose another option to buy or a good or service. And what I think people saw with the financial crisis on both the right and the left, and by the way, I know people think that libertarianism was on the right, but it's not. It's embedded deeply in both parties. It just looks kind of different. It has different flavors. Mm. For example, the general counsel at Uber is Tony West, who was a high-level Obama appointee, and the brother-in-law of Kamala Harris.
What does left libertarianism look like?
I think it looks like, you know, this kind of fetishization of grassroots, the idea that politics is dirty, right? I think some of what you see on the Democratic side, you know, when I think Obama said, you know, I want to do it, but you have to make me do it, right? That's a variant of libertarianism, right?
Or like,
you're saying... Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I think a lot of the variety of libertarianism in Silicon Valley is a sort of like, you know, left neoliberalism. It's much more okay with wealth redistribution. It just generally thinks, you know, the free market is generally good, but we also need, you know, the government to step in as umpire and come in and, you know, fix regulations now and then. We should have more of a robust social safety net and things like that.
That's why universal basic income is so popular on the internet.
I would say UBI. Right. Government is as umpires. I don't think I wouldn't necessarily call that libertarianism because I think that's the government having an assertive role to set public policy and rules. I would say that, you know, the left libertarianism comes with something like Libra, right, where you saw, you know, you see a whole bunch of people saying, look, we do need this kind of global currency, frictionless currency to help all of these people all over the world to move capital, move money, you know, anywhere instantly, right? Mm. Which is certainly not a view that sovereign institutions, sovereign entities, countries should have power over whether money flows, how money flows. I mean, that's a core attack on sovereignty, and it is a kind of global utopianist sort of leftist vision. So I think that's a really good example. But also, you know, the idea that Mark Zuckerberg is saying he should have this a Supreme Court, right? A private Supreme Court. That's a very much, you know, you see a lot of like kind of lefty academics talking about how important that is and really sort of thinking about how do you transfer free speech norms to these private companies is very much a left, it's very much a left libertarian view.
I don't know if I would characterize that as left libertarian. I mean, like, I see what you're saying, you know, particularly in the crypto world about there being a certain amount of like sort of left anarchism or left libertarianism, the old sort of, you know, John Perry Barlow manifesto for cyberspace thinking. But I think a lot of, you know, talking to a lot of the crypto guys, they don't like Libra at all. Like, they think it's too centralized. They think it's too much of a corporate thing. A lot of those guys' ambitions is more to have
decentralization.
Just to
explain here for anybody who doesn't know, Libra was the, you know, semi-cryptocurrency that was proposed by Facebook in order to, with the ultimate goal of replacing a global payment system that and a reserve currency. And the crypto argument, cryptocurrencies, would be much more in favor of something like Bitcoin, which is a decentralized P2P system, which does not have inherent control. But
they're both basically non-dollar ways of creating private currencies. They're private currencies.
Which goes to your core argument, which is that is an attack on sovereignty itself. Yeah. But I think this is also interesting because what I wanted to get you on in here, Matt, was where did the populist left backlash on tech come from? I mean, I have a quote here from 2011, President Obama's State of the Union address. America is, quote, the country of Google and Facebook. It does not get more, you know, more celebratory than that. I think, like you said, it was the peak of American capitalism, the highlight of our society. That is not something you would imagine from a Democrat today, or at the very least, they would be talking about. And there are concerns about this in the mainstream today. We see it on the discussion around Russia and elections, but what is the root in the populist left of the tech backlash?
Well, I think you do still see some Democrats and Republicans talking about, you know, Google and Facebook with pride. You see it a lot less, but you still see, you know, this sort of sense.
Shouldn't there be a bit of pride? I mean, it's a great search engine.
Yeah.
No, there's.
You said pride in a way.
These are not companies to be proud of. You know, the technology is wonderful, but the technology was largely. These are largely financial holding companies that have captured control of these technologies. You know, there's incredible innovation among the engineers, but you know, the guys running these companies at this point are financiers. You know, they're not actually producing anything. It's like, should you be proud of, you know, Bob Iger at Disney for, you know, a great Disney movie? Like, no, he didn't do those movies. Like, he is, you know, talking to he's financializing, right? He's like Peter Thiel now.
Yeah.
Well, his job.
Oh, that's coming soon.
What you're seeing is the backlash is coming because. You know, traditionally, American the best of America has been in protecting the people that produce things, the engineers, the workers, the farmers, artists, from the financier and the monopolist and the aristocrat, right? On the left and the right. That's why.
What's an example on the right of that?
Well, I think you saw, you know, Henry Simons would be an example in the 1930s at the University of Chicago, a positive program for laissez-faire. Or, you know, you saw the Republican Party in the 19th century was very much trying to protect producers. You know, I think you saw, I mean, there's even some stuff in Alexander Hamilton, the report on manufacturers, which was about protecting the ability of the U.S. to create gunpowder, right? Because the British had a gunpowder monopoly because they used sort of predatory pricing techniques. You know, I think you could find. It's all over the place. But now you see it in the kind of Rubio, Hawley, Cotton, those three who are saying, "Hey, we actually have to care about production." I think you see some of it with Donald Trump, where some of the tariff arguments, some of the populist nationalism, is really about protecting the producer, the ability to make things. You know, you see it in the national security world. So it's all over the place. Mm. It's just that the kind of intellectual framework of neoliberalism, which is really a consumer oriented frame, obscures that that kind of deeper sense. I mean, I know that if you talk to, you know, white working class voters who pick Donald Trump, a lot of them are like, they'll say, you know, we used to make things in this country and now we don't, right? That's a producerist framework, right? And that's kind of what it gets to.
That's a good point. Zach, I do want to get also into just the specifics here, because this is also policy-minded, which is you have these populist Republicans and Democrats like Josh Hawley, like Elizabeth Warren. They have propositions to regulate the tech industry. What exactly are they proposing and what do they mean?
I mean, they're coming at it from a lot of different angles here, right? Yeah. So, I mean, we could spend a whole hour talking about any one of them. I mean, some of the big themes... antitrust is obviously one of them. There's been a lot of talk in tech world about changing something called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which provides a liability shield for platforms that are reliant on user-generated content. So people like Facebook and Google and Twitter have a big stake in that.
Right. Could you talk about what the world would look like without the current Section 230 protections?
Yeah. So Hawley has a bill on this, which is quite aggressive, which would make protections for big platforms. So it has to be over a certain size, but it wouldn't just get Google and Facebook. It would get probably a lot of video game companies and Reddit and
It's important to know what is a platform too, right? Because that's sort of like where the debate comes.
So in this context, there's a specific statutory definition in the 96 Telecom Act that 230 protects
interactive computer exchange. Right?
This exempts some things like intellectual property. But so Hawley's approach is to sort of make this conditional on being audited by the Federal Trade Commission, have a supermajority of commissioners come in and say you're okay, you're not politically biased, or you are politically biased.
It's like the fairness doctrine.
Get it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
Someone sounds like a libertarian over here.
I think the fairness doctrine is a good thing.
Right. Oh, interesting.
It's like the fairness doctrine.
Yeah.
when conservatives say that, it's an attack.
Oh,
so
okay,
I was thinking
yeah.
of that.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
Yeah, right. No, I, go on. Not just 2:30. I know there are other
things. But yeah,
other
I should whistle it and skip. Yeah. Yeah. I was whistling and skipping.
Well, the White House is considering an executive order that would police alleged bias on online platforms mm-hmm. by empowering the FCC and FTC.
So you just said alleged bias. Why are you putting alleged in front of bias?
Well, people
I mean, they don't really have the authority to do that.
Well,
so
the, yeah,
you can,
this goes to a much bigger question.
Well, you can write an executive order, but like you can't.
I have not seen the specific language, but I'm guessing, you know, particularly given their track record with the
build
executive
a firewall.
Orders. Yeah,
yeah, right.
It may or may not hold up. We'll
I think
see.
That's a good point. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about here actually was the whole bias argument, which
right.
is that conservatives approach much of their grievances with technology beginning with bias. And
right.
I think the question, Zach, is like, if you want to have a serious discussion around technology, bias doesn't seem like, to me, the place that you should start.
Right. And I don't know that that's really like Senator Hawley's actual underlying concern either. Mm. We can get into that. And I say alleged bias because are there incidents of anti-conservative bias? I'm sure there are. Like, are the question is that a systemic major problem.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not convinced by the evidence out there that it is. That being said, like, people on the progressive left have been thinking about algorithmic bias a lot longer than people on the right and tend to have much more sophisticated arguments mm-hmm. about it. For instance, they'll, you know, there was a big thing a few months ago where conservatives were criticizing Google News for, you know, not having, you know, Breitbart and the Daily Wire up next to the New York Times. And while the explanation for that is that Google's algorithm, you know, says quality and relevance is based on how popular you are.
Right, and so, link backs, right.
Yeah,
right.
Link backs, exactly. It goes back to page rank. And, you know, that means it's the Wall Street Journal and Fox News, but that's about it for conservative outlets because the others just aren't anywhere near those in terms of popularity. The more sophisticated version of the criticism isn't that they're biased against conservatives, but they're biased to big mainstream sites, right? And is that a good thing or not a good thing, right? And so I think the conservative bias argument, like I said, it isn't super compelling. It's hard to tell, you know, because they aren't super transparent about how where exactly that falls. But I'm generally pretty skeptical of it. I think it is a legitimate concern, particularly for social conservatives, thinking about where people draw the lines on content policy. Particularly getting into sort of what you can advertise and what you can't, where there's usually more strict standards about
right.
content. So
the thing that's interesting about the bias debate is it seems to me the reason why you'll never see a broad bipartisan coalition sort of against monopoly, against sort of tech companies would be that the second the bias debate starts, it becomes about diamond and silk. It becomes about the exact sort of things that would break apart a left-right coalition. What do you think about that, Matt?
Well,
especially from the left, right? How do you approach
right. so,
the
I mean,
bias debate?
The most interesting thing here to have somebody who's a member of the populist left who wants to take on technology is what are the conditions that the right need to set in order to make it a viable legislative coalition?
So you're talking about tech broadly or just this bias question?
Well, no, I'm saying does the focus on bias make it more difficult
yeah,
in order to
it
create
does.
A bias?
The problem with that is that it's about centralizing power and repurposing that power to privilege one particular faction, which happens to be a conservative faction. And I think that makes it really hard to take conservatives in good faith. So with someone like, say, Ted Cruz, who makes a big deal of conservative bias, you know, it's hard for me to take him in good faith. Now, with someone like Senator Hawley, I do take him in good faith because he has a pretty strong track record of doing a bunch of things on technology that do get after that core question of concentrations of power. Everything from, you know, dark patterns, which are basically false and deceptive advertising by technology companies and video game companies, to making sure that there are standards at the SEC to account for the value of data, which is a basic investor protection and a basic kind of anti-monopoly tool. Things like pressuring the FTC after the ridiculous kind of get out of jail free card that they gave to Facebook recently. There's just a lot of things that Senator Hawley has done that suggest to me that he's operating in good faith. The conservative bias stuff, I don't like the way that he did the Section 230 bill, but I do think that, you know, we have to figure out what to do about 230 because, you know, basically the law was written to so that AOL could manage chat rooms in 1996. And now it's extending over all businesses in the entire economy. Obviously, we need to change that law. It doesn't make any sense. Now, the way that you do that, there are a lot of different arguments for how to do that. But the problem right now is that most of the academics that are making arguments to preserve Section 230 are in the pocket of Google. And so the debates are so bad faith because it's just protect Google's business model or in Facebook's business model, or, you know, empower the conservative movement to bully algorithms in a centralized way. And you're not going to get the populist left on that. I think you're going to lose a lot of populist right on that too, because it's not the real problem here.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a looming, to a broader discussion point, there's a looming sort of feature of this debate, which is great power competition with China. Recently, Peter Thiel has come up in this conversation, obviously has accused Google of basically being infested with Chinese spies, especially in their artificial intelligence sections. What do the two of you make of that argument, especially on the national security side?
What do you think, Zach?
Well, I mean, it's not just, I think, Peter Thiel. I think there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley that I've talked to, you know, view Google in a different light after some of the stuff with Project Maven that ties into some of this.
Let's explain what Project Maven is.
Sure. Yeah. It was a work they were doing with the Defense Department to help with, I believe, computer vision. I think it was related to their TensorFlow product, but I have to go look up the details. And they had a sort of, you know, group of activist employees kind of rebel against this program and that the management decided to terminate. And there have been, you know, since then a number of other incidents at other companies and at Google several times as well. I think people were protesting Microsoft, I believe, for their HoloLens project and serving to the military. I think Microsoft's response was basically that, we appreciate your concern, but we're a patriotic company, so go pound sand, you know. Mm-hmm. And Google and Facebook and some of the other younger companies seem to have, you know, they seem to like be letting a lot of the sort of activist employees sort of run the show a little bit more.
And so Peter's concern, right, is that Google is not a patriotic company because it chooses to pursue projects with the Chinese government, or at least companies
more open to it.
Is more open to cooperation with China, and at the same time is not working with the United States military.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think they see them as sort of, how should I put this? Like a lot of, so, you know, there's definitely like a lot of the sort of folks that work with the U.S. government in Silicon Valley, of which there are some. I mean, Silicon Valley has deep roots in the sort of defense sector and working with DARPA
from
products.
Right, so.
Yeah. Exactly. Literally. Like people talk about it as a sort of, you know, libertarian, like Ayn Rand protagonist forging something from nothing.
DARPA products, yeah.
Right, yeah. If you hold up, you know,
Silicon Valley burst forth from Zeus's head.
Right. The brow of Zeus.
Untouched by nature.
Right. Well, I mean, the history
is... In a perfect vision, sorry. I'm just mad that you didn't like my build a firewall joke.
Oh, I
thought that was a great joke.
No, it was a good one.
Sorry. You were saying.
If you look at your smartphone, a lot of the core foundational technologies there come out of like government programs, whether
you're a communist.
Just a realist, right?
Well, I know, and I think this is interesting, Matt. I mean, one of the most interesting things about you is that you are you're on the populist left, but you are a big China hawk. And I mean, how is your thinking intersecting whenever it comes to these things like the Google's Maven project?
I just love when you say one of the most interesting things about him is, oh, stop. Yeah. Oh, stop. Go
well,
on.
You know,
stop.
I'm a professional interviewer.
Yeah,
so, you
okay.
Know.
I mean, I look at China and I think that the you know, they're like Nazi Germany in the 30s, right? We have really serious, really serious problems. And we're actually in a, you know, we have massive dependencies on China. I don't really know what to do about it. But, you know, I do look at them and I think that we have... you know, we have a really serious problem with an expansionist fascist power that wants to undermine a whole bunch of things that I care about in America. And I think you have Silicon Valley is a massive, these dominant monopolists are, is a massive national security risk because they are fundamentally lawless and they have no allegiance to kind of Western liberal democratic norms. So, you know,
why is that?
I think it has to do with this sort of kind of weird libertarianism. I mean, they really just don't believe in national boundaries. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg said to Xi Jinping, this was reported in the New York Times a few years ago, that he offered Xi Jinping the honor of naming his first child, right? This is a guy that really wanted to get into China, right? And this is the guy that we've decided, oh, let's put the entire communications apparatus or social networking of the entire Western world in his hands. It seems like a problem, right?
How's the left approaching the China debate? Because I don't really hear China hawking left that much, especially in the context
of— Well, I just want to say something mean about Google. So just hang on a second.
Yeah, that's of course.
Just hold on. I'll get there. Yeah. You know, Google establishes an AI center in, I guess, like Shanghai or Beijing, and they're putting a lot of resources into research in China. And then they say they want to work with the U.S. military. And I think that's, you know, that's really dangerous. And I don't think it's because, you know, they have some activist employees, but I don't think they care what those activist employees say. I think they don't want to work with the Pentagon for other reasons. I'm not sure what they are, but I suspect it's probably because they don't think that the work would be profitable enough. At any rate, these countries, these companies are, I think that they are really dangerous. I suspect they probably are infested with Chinese espionage agents. I would, if I were a high-level official in the Chinese Communist Party, I would certainly try to get people inside Google. Why wouldn't you? So I imagine that's the case.
Well, I mean, Thiel's argument was also that they were advertising that they were doing a Manhattan Project on AI or whatever they were calling it.
Well, no, and so Peter's argument, which was
let's not oversee. These are lazy companies. Like Google and Facebook are insanely lazy. And, you know, the engineers, this is the problem when you don't have competition. Like, they're not very good at things. You know, like, Google did awesome work in the late 1990s. But really, since then, they've been buying up other companies and they've been spending time sort of playing pricing games and trying to improve their ad tech services. But mostly, you know, what does Larry Page do? He thinks about, like, oh, how can we deliver internet access through, like, large balloons? It's like, oh, come on. That's ridiculous. If you actually force them to compete, they would be improving their systems and their products, and they haven't done that for quite some time. I mean, you look at Facebook. It's a worse product today than it was 10 years ago. Zach,
yeah. I mean, like, X has generated some cool stuff.
What's X?
It's their, like, moonshot factory that I think you were alluding to. Like, Waymo came out of that. It's a big self-driving car company. They've done some, like, smart contact lenses.
Well, wait. Hang on a second. Yeah. Self-driving cars don't exist. There's a lot of press releases.
I've ridden in one. They totally exist.
Yeah.
No, like Epcot-style self-driving cars exist, but actually being able to drive. I mean, this is the problem when you don't actually have to run things in markets, right? When you just have a money printing machine from a monopoly, they're essentially directing the money that used to go to journalism to really cool experiments in safe self-driving cars that don't actually deliver self-driving cars.
On your journalism point, you're referencing the fact that Google's ad revenue spend tends to take from money that would have gone to publishers in the past.
Yes, you know, they have $116 billion of revenue, like in I think it was the last year, and that's coming from what used to be journalism, right? So now we have a whole bunch of cities and counties. Two-thirds actually of American counties have no daily newspaper anymore. And one of the things you find is when a town loses its newspaper, its borrowing costs go up because there's an increase in the level of political corruption.
Well, so this is something. This is something that Marshall and I focus on as media fellows here, which is that. How is it that we go forward, right? Because it's not just Google and Facebook, which brought down the modern business model of journalism. It was also Craigslist. I mean, Google and Facebook are fundamentally better ad products than what a local newspaper used to be in terms of targeted advertising. So I think, Zach, the question is, I mean, is it fair necessarily to blame Google and Facebook for creating a better ad product? And how should we be thinking about how to save journalism in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put so much blame on them. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, technologies inherently have disruptions, but they also bring us tremendous benefits. And I don't think we need to sort of build policy around an analog business model. I don't think that's good for people. I have access to thousands and thousands of really interesting online publications now, and many of the
they all don't make any money though because the business model's gone.
A lot of them have to be. Sure.
They're giving away free content and begging for scraps. That's true.
I mean, a lot of them, other than the really big ones, you know, have to go to a different model, often subsidized by foundations or philanthropy. You know, we're in a place where they're adapting, and do we say that, you know, you tax Google to subsidize journalism? I guess we could do that. I don't know if that's why that would be the right answer.
No, and I agree. My point isn't to say that I think the government should intervene in the journalism sphere. I'm just saying that there's the notion that thousands of publishers are succeeding in a world where basically an online ad gets you 0.00001 cents is not true.
That means that competition is working, though. There's lots more competition for online, you know, products that people consume. A lot of people are, you know, there's more content in my Twitter or Facebook feed from different articles than I would read if I didn't have Twitter or Facebook.
Right. Well, I mean, this goes to a bigger question here, which you were alluding to, Matt, which was about innovation. And it was about, this is another theme from the Peter Thiel discussion, which is that we were promised Star Trek and we might have the Star Trek computer, but we're not actually living in a Star Trek world. We don't have flying cars. We don't have transportation.
No replicators.
There's no replicators. Yeah. There's not a lot of the... Not, I think he calls it in the world of atoms, we're not doing so well, but in the world of bits that we're living in that Star Trek universe.
Right.
Matt, how is it that we could get to a Star Trek universe?
So I would just say, like, I think there's a lot less competition in, particularly in local news, than there used to be. There's a lot less, just a lot less journalism. I mean, you've laid off, you know, half, two-thirds of the industry, something like that. So it's like, you can certainly get a lot of websites, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean you're getting, like, if you just go to, you know, the state houses or the city halls or the courts, you know, there used to be journalists there writing down what happened, and now there aren't, right? So there's, that product is gone. And that's, and I think that that is 100% because of the shift that took place to concentrate power in the hands of Google and Facebook, right? And that we didn't have to make that shift, and we can reverse it, but we've made that shift. In terms of the capacity to innovate, I mean, let's talk about what we've destroyed, right? Because I think it's important to recognize that not only are things not better today, but they're actually worse. I looked at the U.S. Trade Representative's hearings on the new China tariffs, where all these companies come and trade associations complain about, well, we can't, don't put these tariffs because it's going to hurt our business. And it was like everyone from optical scanners to wedding and prom dress makers to iRobot, you know, robot maker. Like, they were saying, we cannot make these things in America anymore. There is a loss of productive capacity. And I bring up Boeing because airplanes, the gift of flight, is something that is remarkable. And the idea that we can't make airplanes anymore in the U.S., I mean, what a loss for us as a society. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Mostly they have to do with the dominance of finance over production. Right. It also has to do with a lack of competition, as you saw, you know, some mergers in the 1990s. But you see that in every area of the political economy. It's systemic at this point. So whereas the last place where there really was competition was in the online ad space and the technology space, largely because of the Microsoft suit, there hasn't been a real antitrust suit for a really long time. And you have seen roll-ups in every sector. And so you're seeing not only not a lot of innovation, but also a collapse in capacity. And it's incredibly scary and dangerous.
In the sake of fairness, Matt, just to go back to the journalism point, there are rumors, or actually there's pretty much an announcement that Facebook is going to be paying publishers to host news content on the site. What's your reaction to that? Because there's an argument that Facebook, because of how powerful it is, how much profit it generates, it's capable of subsidizing those sort of activities.
Well, I mean, I would just say that, you know, conservatives have a legitimate argument about government-funded news, right? Which is, the government's going to fund news, and it's not necessarily going to fund news that's going to be skeptical of government, right? And I think you see the same problem here, which is Facebook is going to, they're not going to certainly they won't finance, say, The Guardian, which exposed Cambridge Analytica. They will use their financing to play favorites. And to prioritize their own political agenda. So fundamentally, I don't like the idea of taxing Google and Facebook and subsidizing news. I think that's a problem. I also think that having a healthy advertising market is really important. And since the early 1800s, the American press has been based on having an advertising industry. And that's because advertising is a mechanism of financing speech that does not rely on the state. And so you can have skepticism towards the state, and you can have skepticism towards private power as well. And having private power finance journalism is fundamentally dangerous.
Do you think subscriptions could? Because that's sort of what people are trying to do now that advertising doesn't work.
Well, let me give you an example of why I pin this on Google and Facebook. It's just something I wrote about today in a newsletter I have. It's this thing called the incognito mode on the Chrome browser.
Of course.
Right? So there's something called a metered paywall. One of the ways that a lot of these news outlets are trying to get subscribers is they say you get 3 articles free, but then you have to subscribe. And this is a way of giving people a little bit of the product and then encouraging them to subscribe, right? But in order to know if you've gotten 3 articles, they have to put a cookie on your machine. And so what a lot of people do is they use the incognito mode, and the incognito mode allows them to look at, get an infinite number of free articles, essentially to avoid the metered paywall.
That would push them to subscribe normally.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So newspaper publishers figured out a way to detect if someone was incognito mode and say, okay, you're in incognito mode. You don't get any free articles, right? Google just patched that on Chrome. And they said, okay, we're going to make it impossible for publishers to tell whether you're in incognito mode or not, effectively getting rid of metered paywalls. And what they told publishers is either do a hard paywall or give away your content for free. And they just made that decision because they like to have
certain... Well, to be fair, and I want to get Zach in on this, but their argument is that is a security patch because it defeats the entire purpose of incognito mode, right?
Right. I mean, you could make the argument. Yeah. Like, and Google has made the argument with other standards that it's set, like accelerated mobile pages or first click free, which was said if you're a Google user, you get to look at the first... if you go to the Wall Street Journal, you get to read that. And if Wall Street Journal doesn't allow that, they're going to downgrade that in search results. There are always consumer-based arguments for why this is better. There are always technical arguments for why this is better. It's just that it always coincidentally aligns with Google's interests. And certainly it's true that if you steal a truckload of televisions and sell them for half off, it's better for the consumer. But we don't allow that for a reason. So the idea that Google would have the power to set the terms and conditions and the layout of publishers when they're trying to get subscriptions, I mean, that is a lot of power. And if you are under the thumb of Google to even figure out whether you can get customers, I don't think that we can make a credible argument that this is just technology, or, oh, this is just the internet, oh, it's a better product, and so they just innovated. No, they're using power to break the arms of the potential competitors or of the institutions that they want to disempower. It's pretty clear.
Go ahead, Zach.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sympathetic.
No one saw that coming.
Like, yeah, weird. I don't know. I'm sympathetic more than some libertarian-leaning people about arguments around soft power. I think in many ways this whole sort of post-Trump moment is shifting from an analysis of sort of like rights and laws to analysis of power dynamics, which is super interesting. And Hawley and people like that get that. But that being said, I don't know if publishers have a right to a certain business model that browsers have to sort of cater around. I'm sympathetic to the argument that it would be nice if there was more competition in that space and that might provide a viable option, but I don't know if the news industry...
There, we agree. I'll take yes for an answer. We should have more antitrust. I agree. Yeah. Google should be broken up. So all right, we're
actually
done.
That's actually
I don't know. Why is that the right answer? Why does sort of separating Instagram from Facebook make them better?
Well, if you separated Chrome from search, then there wouldn't be the incentive to, use this kind of power. Like, because what Google is doing... With its Chrome browser, well, I mean, they certainly, I think you can make arguments for why it's a good idea, and you can also make arguments for why it's
I mean, does
it's
Safari
self-serving.
Do that? Does Firefox do that?
Well, I think it's a different question. I mean, I think you can certainly make the argument for why it's a good idea, but you can also make an argument that it's no doubt conflicted, right? Mm-hmm. So if you separated out Chrome from from search, then they would be making the decision purely on the technical merits, right? And they're not right now.
Yeah. I just don't know if, like, that in itself is going to, really produce great yields for consumers or address any of these sort of harms that people are talking about. And it seems like at least, someone who's sort of observed the complaints of the populist right, I mean, I think they would come at it from a very different perspective. They don't want to tinker around the edges of what the journalism business model is. And I think in like Josh Hawley's case, if you read his, you know, writings in First Things and places like that. Like, he thinks, I think, social media platforms are bad for society and, you know, fundamentally wants to sort of undo the current business model.
Well, this and this,
well, that's social media. That's not search.
Right.
Right. So.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, and these are important distinctions. And this is also what we wanted to get at here, which is like, what are the fundamental populist left, populist right concerns? I mean, we're running out of time. So one of the real things that we wanted to get to from both of you was, you know, put on your hat, Matt, where you want to see the tech industry repair its relationship. Like put on the hat of the other side. What would it take for the tech industry to repair its relationship to the populist left without a government intervention?
Well, I don't think that there is a necessarily antagonism. First of all, I don't speak for the populist left. I guess I should say that. I'm known as the guy that's like, Obama was a bad president, and that's just not where they are necessarily. And I am also not a socialist, right? So there's definitely, you know, you've got a socialist vibe to some of that. And then you've got kind of a bunch of people who are populists. But I'm sorry, I kind of spaced
just
for a second.
How could the tech industry repair
its relationship? Let's just distinguish between tech executives and kind of the industry writ large. Because I think that really the engineers have different views than the executives, right? So Larry Page is just in a different position than, you know, a lot of the engineers who came to Google because they either applied for jobs or some of them, you know, they were bought out. And I think that I think there's a lot of support within Silicon Valley for breaking up these companies. I know that a lot of people, I mean, this is what Kara Swisher said, but she said, you know, I know people at Instagram want to be spun off from Facebook. And I know that, you know, she's the same thing with YouTube. They think they're carrying the company and so on and so forth. So I think that there's a desire to be liberated from the financial holding company sort of overlords.
Interesting.
And that's kind of what we're talking about, is it's like, if you want to create, you're prevented from creating because we have these kind of dominant lords over the entire swaths of the industry.
At the same time, like, a lot of the guys doing startups, just like their dream is to be like bought up by Facebook or Google.
No, that's their model. That's not a no one's dream as an 8-year-old is to sell their company, right? Like their model is to is to sell, but that's not a function of that's not a dream, right? Mm-hmm. That's just like, I want to get rich. Maybe that's kind of, but like engineers want to build things.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah. No, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying there's something, you know, wrong with wanting to get rich. But what I'm saying is that when you talk about a creator or an artist, right? You say take a director or an actor or a writer. Like, they go into that into filmmaking because they want to create art. You talk to Boeing engineers; they want to create airplanes. That's what they love to do. And engineers want to create things. They want to build. That's what they love to do. Now, would they like to get rich? I'm sure they would. But the dream is not just to extract and get a lot of money. The dream is to build something that changes the world. And they're prevented from doing that right now. Hmm.
Zach, what's your answer to what tech companies, let's say the industry broadly, can do to repair its relationship with the populist right?
Oof. You know, I think we could spend a whole podcast on that. But I think a lot of their engagement has been sort of coming to D.C. quickly. I mean, some of them, like Google and the sort of telecoms, have been here a long time. Microsoft has been here a long time. But some of the, like, younger ones have come in and built offices relatively quickly here. A lot of their engagement has been taking the D.C. ecosystem as is, right? Like, the institutions here are sort of what the right-wing movement looks like. And I think, in reality, the sort of populist, you know, the real, like, Republican voter is very different from, like, what the Cato Institute says or what AEI says.
Yes.
And particularly, I think the institutions here lean more towards free market orthodoxies, you know, more libertarian, even at ones that don't brand as libertarian. And I think the actual base is, like, much more closer to Tucker Carlson than Milton Friedman. And that, you know, in the sort of after Trump era, people are starting to realize that that's an opportunity to exploit. And so I think companies need to sort of realign how they see the right and start, you know, seriously approaching some, you know, other factions other than the people who think, you know, they're private companies and therefore that's the end of the conversation, right? Because that's not where most of the right is.
Yeah.
Well, there you have.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't actually say how do they repair it with the populist left. I think that the Democrats are in a different position where they are really confused,
I mean, you don't see a lot of conversation about China, for example. You do see some conversation among a bunch of the leaders, and and there is sort of some arguments about corporate power, but it is a kind of an open question about how much Democrats, who are largely in that kind of, a lot of them are in a professional class, there is a kind of open question about whether they really care about corporate power. I think they do, but I don't think they necessarily see that as part of politics. And I think that's kind of what we're dealing with right now. We're for 30, 40 years, corporate power was not part of politics. It just wasn't. Politics was something different. And now there's this kind of repoliticization of market power. And I go back and forth on this just because Democrats are so confused about where power actually lives.
Mm. Well, almost like it's the product of a realignment in politics, which is a great segue to our ending. Thank you so much, Matt Stoller, Zach Graves of the Lincoln Network, and Matt of the Open Markets Institute. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Realignment. If you're not already subscribed to the show, make sure you do so wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you've enjoyed it so far, we'd love it if you could rate us 5 stars. See you next week.